Welcome, everyone. My name is Raj Gandhi. I'm at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, and I'm going to be speaking today about HIV-associated opportunistic infections. This is the third in a series of lectures on this topic. The first two are presented during the live course by Dr. Henry Mazur and by me, and this is the third in that series. I would like to thank Dr. Henry Mazur for sharing some of the slides that you'll see here today. So I have no relevant disclosures. And let's go ahead and get started. So we're going to be talking about four main areas. We're going to talk about a variety of mucocutaneous infections, including Candida, varicella zoster virus, herpes simplex virus, and Epstein-Barr virus associated complications. We'll talk about fungal infections other than cryptococcal meningitis, which is covered in another lecture, as well as Candida. We'll talk about a variety of HIV-associated gastrointestinal opportunistic complications. And finally, we'll be talking about cytomegalovirus or CMV infections. So mucocutaneous candidiasis and esophageal candidiasis are common in people with HIV who have a CD4 cell count of less than 200. Esophageal candidiasis, which is characterized by odynephagia, typically occurs at lower CD4 cell counts than oropharyngeal candidiasis. Most instances of candidiasis in people with HIV are due to Candida albicans, and invasive candidiasis, by contradistinction, is not HIV related. So, for example, Candida in a bloodstream infection, should raise suspicion for catheter related infections or injection drug use rather than advanced HIV. I'm showing you here some pictures of different varieties or types of oropharyngeal candidiasis. On your left is the pseudomembranous type, which is characterized by a whitish plaques, which scrape off with a tongue blade. In the middle is erythematous candidiasis, which often is characterized by pain and intense erythema. And then the third type of oropharyngeal candidiasis is angular chelosis, where you get evidence of candidiasis at the corners of the mouth. The last of these can be treated sometimes with topical antifungal therapy. So these are the three types of oropharyngeal candidiasis to consider. Esophageal candidiasis, by contradistinction, is when the candida extends down deep into the esophagus, and here you're seeing the widest plaques of candida extending into an individual's esophagus. In terms of management of mucocutaneous candidiasis in people with HIV, fluconazole primary prophylaxis or chronic suppression is not recommended. This is in large part because of the concerns for resistance, which can occur if fluconazole is used extensively. People with advanced HIV. Treatment, however, should be given if people do develop candidiasis. For oral candidiasis, it's typically fluconazole, 100 to 200 milligrams daily, except during pregnancy. Topical miconazole is another option, or clotrimazole troches, or nystatin. These are all reasonable options for oral candidiasis. Esophageal candidiasis, though, which is when the candida extends down deeper, should be treated with systemic therapy, and is typically treated with fluconazole for anywhere from 14 to 21 days. Now let's go on to another condition that can be seen in people with advanced HIV, and these are aphthous ulcers. What you're seeing here is an aphthous ulcer right here on the mucosa. And then you can also see a large aphthous ulcer in another photograph, this time on the lip. This brings up the differential diagnosis of painful swallowing in people with advanced HIV, odynephagia or painful swallowing. The first of these is esophageal candidiasis, as we've already talked about. Aphthous ulcers of the sort that I showed you in the oropharynx can also extend down into the esophagus. And when it does, that can then be presenting with odynephagia. Two other infectious considerations are herpes simplex virus esophagitis and cytomegalovirus esophagitis. So these are the four common causes of odynephagia in people with advanced HIV. In terms of how to distinguish these, usually we start with a treatment for esophageal candidiasis, and we anticipate with fluconazole therapy that the symptoms will resolve. However, if the symptoms persist, then it's important to do an endoscopy to look for some of the other causes listed on this slide. And now let's shift gears to talk about herpes zoster. Before antiretroviral therapy in a person before they're treated, there's a 15-fold higher incidence of zoster than in the general population, so really a very substantial risk of zoster. After someone is treated with antiretroviral therapy, there's still an increased risk even when they're on suppressive therapy. Localized or dermatomal zoster may occur at all CD4 cell counts, And it's more frequent when the CD4 cell count is less than 200 or the HIV RNA is not suppressed by antiretroviral therapy. An important consideration here is that the risk of zoster is increased in the few months following ART initiation, possibly because of immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. And so that's something to keep in mind, is if you start someone with advanced HIV on therapy and they develop zoster, that may be more frequent in those initial months and is an IRIS or immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome manifestation. Here are some other photographs and examples of localized and disseminated herpes zoster. You're seeing in the top left a dermatomal zoster, a classic picture of group vesicles. You can also get disseminated zoster or primary varicella, that's shown in the bottom left. Ophthalmic zoster, which we'll talk about momentarily, is a feared complication. And here's a photograph of someone with ophthalmic zoster. And then don't forget that people can get herpes sine zoster, that is herpes zoster without the rash, and that can present with pain or other neurologic manifestations. A word about zoster ophthalmicus. This is when the VZV virus reactivates in the ophthalmic branch of cranial nerve 5. This is showing you in the figure on your left where that ophthalmic branch is. So keep that in mind in terms of where the dermatomal distribution or the ophthalmic branch distribution is of that. This then is shown on your right in terms of how that might manifest, again, with a dermatomal rash in the distribution of the ophthalmic branch of cranial nerve 5. A sign to know is Hutchinson's sign. This can be a precursor to VZV-related eye disease. This is because of involvement of the nasociliary nerve of the ophthalmic branch of cranial nerve 5. The hallmark here is vesicles on the tip of the nose or vesicles on the side of the nose. And so that's shown in some of these pictures on the top two panels. This is a particular harbinger of the development of ocular manifestations. And those ocular manifestations can include corneal manifestations, a keratitis shown on the bottom left, and can also be a precursor to a retinitis or anterior uveitis. So don't forget Hutchinson's sign as a precursor to VZV eye disease. Another complication of a zoster can be zoster ophthalmicus related stroke. This is due to vascular inflammation and occlusion of the blood vessel. This can occur days or months after zoster. The median is about 4 months after a clinical episode of herpes zoster. Sometimes cutaneous lesions can be absent. In about a third of the cases, there'll be no cutaneous lesions. And the diagnosis of zoster ophthalmicus related stroke depends on thinking of the possibility and then sending PCR of cerebrospinal fluid for VZV or demonstrating VZV antibody production in the CSF, so-called intrathecal antibody production, where you're looking at levels of VZV antibody in the CSF and finding them to be higher than VZV antibody in the blood. Another manifestation of zoster which can occur is so-called Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, which is also known as herpes zoster oticus. This is involvement of the geniculate ganglion of cranial nerve 7. Some of the hallmarks of Ramsey-Hunt syndrome include external ear vesicles and facial nerve paralysis. Some of the manifestations can be ear pain, a vesicular rash on the external ear. People can develop a motor neuron paralysis of the facial nerve. There can be loss of taste sensation over the anterior two-thirds of the tongue, as well as at times cranial nerve 8 palsies. And another manifestation can be hearing loss, tinnitus, and vertigo. So remember, Ramsey-Hunt syndrome or herpes zoster oticus. What about prevention of zoster? The recombinant vaccine, RZV vaccine, is really the most important way to prevent zoster. It's recommended in adults with HIV who are 18 years of age and older, regardless of CD4 cell count. The recombinant VZV vaccine or zoster vaccine is a two-dose series at month zero and then at 2 to 6 months. And RZV should not be given during an acute episode of herpes zoster. You should give this vaccine once people have resolved their episode of acute zoster. Now let's switch gears again to talk about herpes simplex virus. Herpes simplex can cause orolabial manifestations. This is actually the most common manifestation of HSV-1 infection. Genital herpes is typically caused by HSV-2, but increasingly in recent years is due to HSV-1. And recurrences in viral shedding are less often with genital HSV-1 than it is with genital HSV-2. Herpes simplex may also present as proctitis in men who have sex with men. And in these individuals with proctitis, they may not have external anal ulcers. So do think of HSV as in the differential diagnosis of proctitis. Disseminated HSV is really quite rare, even in severely immunosuppressed individuals. And then other manifestations of HSV include, and this is particularly true in people with CD4 counts less than 100, HSV esophagitis, as we touched on before, HSV-related retinitis, which presents as acute retinal necrosis. And then finally, people with advanced HIV can develop chronic, extensive, deep genital ulcers due to HSV, and these may be acyclovir-resistant, particularly if people have been previously treated with this drug. Here's a very typical example of localized herpes simplex with, again, the group vesicles on a erythematous base. And then this is what I mentioned before. This is the chronic, extensive perirectal HSV in people with low CD4 cell counts. And do look for, in this condition, acyclovir resistance. The way to do so is to do viral culture and phenotypic testing. And the treatment for acyclovir-resistant HSV is intravenous foscarnet. So remember, chronic extensive perirectal HSV may occur in people with HIV and may be acyclovir-resistant. Now let's talk about a couple of EBV-associated conditions. In fact, let's talk particularly about oral hairy leukoplakia. These are some photographs of OHL. What you can see here are these wattish plaques on the sides of the tongue, several different photographs of oral hairy leukoplakia. In distinction to Canada, pseudomembranous candidiasis, those plaques in Canada will brush off with a tongue blade, whereas with oral hairy leukoplakia, these wattish plaques will not be dislodgeable with tongue blade. So do take the time to see if someone's plaque come off with a tongue blade, and that can help you in the differential between Canada and EBV associated. So again, oral hairy leukoplakia, an EBV associated condition. This is yet another picture, and you can really see a very prominent example of the whitish plaques on the sides of the tongue that don't scrape off with the tongue blade. So here are the two conditions in HIV that are associated with EBV. One is oral hairy leukoplakia, and the other, as a reminder, is primary central nervous system lymphoma. This is uniformly related to EBV. This occurs in people with HIV whose CD4 count is typically less than 50. Here are some other dermatologic findings in people with HIV just to keep in mind. On your left is prurigo nodularis. These are sometimes hyperpigmented subcutaneous nodules that occur in areas of pruritus. So if you see a nodular rash like this in an area where someone cannot reach and cannot scratch, then that may not be prurigo nodularis. But if it fits that pattern in terms of areas of pruritus, then it could be prurigo nodularis. And then on the right is a very typical picture of Kaposi's sarcoma. This is an HHV8 associated condition. You can see these purplish plaques. These plaques sometimes occur in cosmetically disturbing parts of the body, such as the face. So do remember Kaposi's sarcoma and also prurigo nodularis as dermatologic findings in people with HIV. Okay, so now let's talk about our second main topic. We're now going to talk about fungal infections. In a prior lecture, we already covered cryptococcal meningitis, so we won't repeat that here. And earlier in this lecture, we talked about Candida. So these now are going to be fungal infections other than cryptococcal meningitis and other than candidiasis. So let's cover the following fungi. We're going to talk about Cryptococcus again, but here we're going to focus on cutaneous and prostate disease. We'll also talk about Tularemyces, we'll talk about histoplasmosis, and we'll talk about coccidioidomycosis. So these are the fungal infections that we'll talk about next. So let's start out with cryptococcal prostate abscess. I'm showing you a case that I saw during my fellowship. This is a man with advanced HIV, CD4 cell count of 40. His HIV RNA was 225,000. He was not on antiretroviral therapy. And this particular patient presented with 4 weeks of pain on defecation. What you're seeing here on a pelvic CT scan is evidence of a prostate abscess. And then what you're also seeing here is on a prostatic aspirate, you're seeing evidence of these organisms. And on a H&E stain, a hematoxylin and eosin stain, you're seeing this organism with an area of clearing or a capsule around it. So this is a very typical picture of a cryptococcal infection in the prostate. Just as a reminder, the prostate can serve as a nidus or focus for cryptococcal abscess in people with advanced HIV. This can take some time to resolve, and people often need prolonged courses of antifungal therapy, typically fluconazole. So remember the prostate as a possible locus for cryptococcal infection in people with advanced HIV. Cryptococcus can also present with mucocutaneous findings. These are some images from the website that I've organized called ID Images. You'll see more of these images on that website. So several such images. These are these facial umbilicated papules that can be manifestations of cryptococcal infection. They can sometimes involve the mucocutaneous, the mucous membranes. And here's a nicer picture of the umbilicated nature of these cryptococcal papules. So think about this possibility in people with advanced HIV. This particular manifestation, people will have these umbilicated papules, but they'll also have systemic signs such as fever, and usually occur in people with a CD4 count of less than 100. Here are some additional images now of a histology. This is a man with advanced HIV, person not on ART, CD4 count of less than 20, presenting with fever, cough, and skin lesions. And this is a silver stain of the skin biopsy showing the organisms. And remember that mucicarmine is a stain that can really distinguish and show you the organisms of Cryptococcus. So if you see a mucicarmine stain showing these type of organisms, think of cryptococcal infection. Now we'll move on to Tayloromyces marneffei. This used to be called Penicillium marneffei. This is a dimorphic fungus, which is endemic in Southeast Asia, East Asia, and South Asia. You can see the map in the bottom left in terms of where this particular dimorphic fungus is typically located. Advanced HIV is a risk factor for severe disease. The skin lesions can present as central necrotic or umbilicated papules. You're seeing such an example on your right with a facial lesion and umbilicated papules on the face. People can then also have pulmonary gastrointestinal involvement, as well as presenting with hepatosplenomegaly. Here are some additional pictures of Tayloromyces. Again, the umbilicated papules on the face. Here is an example of the Tayloromyces causing pulmonary nodules and pulmonary involvement. And then when you do histologic examination, what you'll see are round to oval organisms that are 3 to 6 microns in diameter. And one of the characteristics to look out for on a board review question, on a board question, is that you'll see a midline septum and a dividing yeast cell. So someone from the correct part of the world, advanced HIV with this type of organism, midline septum and a dividing yeast cell, think about the Tayloromyces. Here are some skin lesions for HIV-associated endemic mycoses, and it's just really showing you that these can be hard to distinguish on clinical grounds. You can see Tayloromyces, you can see Cryptococcus, a molluscum, which is also an umbilicated papule, and then finally histoplasmosis. So really it's the company it keeps. The systemic mycoses usually will present with systemic illness like fever. Molluscum typically does not. And so also some other manifestations will help guide you. And then finally, it's important to consider doing a biopsy in order to distinguish between these different manifestations. Some other fungal infections that are covered elsewhere in the board review course. So do look for questions on patients with HIV as well as histoplasma. Here's a typical picture of histoplasma showing you the narrow-based budding of histoplasma. These are small, usually 2 to 5 microns in size. These should be distinguished from the broad-based budding of blastomyces. These are much larger, 10 to 15 microns in size. So broad-based budding of blastomyces. Remember that coccidioides gives you a spherule. These are much larger, 25 to 1,000 microns with these endospores. So this is called a spherule. And then paracoccidioides in South America presents histologically the manifestations is the pilot wheel manifestation of paracoccidioides, and this is about 10 to 20 microns. So many of these are also available for your perusal on idimages.org, the website that I mentioned before. Okay, now we're going to talk about gastrointestinal complications of HIV or GI opportunistic conditions. So here are some of the causes of diarrhea in people with HIV. Think of CMV colitis, which usually presents with bloody diarrhea, can actually be manifesting as intestinal perforation and is almost always limited to people with HIV whose CD4 count is below 100. So CMV colitis is one possibility. There are a number of bacterial causes of diarrhea in people with HIV. These include Salmonella, Shigella, Campylobacter, There's also enteroaggregative E. coli. Clostridioides difficile can present in people with advanced HIV, even if they have not received antibiotics. So do remember that possibility. There are a number of sexually transmitted infections that can present with diarrhea, but also often with manifestations of proctitis or painful defecation. These include lymphogranuloma venereum. Gonococcus or GC can give you a proctitis, and then syphilis can give proctitis. Another bacterial cause of diarrhea can be Mycobacterium avium complex. We talked about this in an earlier lecture. This is usually in people who have a CD4 cell count of less than 50 and typically presents with systemic fevers and other systemic symptoms such as wasting or weight loss. Parasitic causes of diarrhea in people with HIV include Microsporidia and Cryptosporidia. Microsporidia and Cryptosporidia usually occur in people with CD4 counts of less than 100. They present with chronic diarrhea, but they can also manifest with extraintestinal complications, for example, biliary disease or pulmonary disease. Isospora is another parasitic cause of diarrhea in people with HIV, and then Cyclospora, Giardia, and amebiasis are other parasitic causes. Cancer, such as Kaposi sarcoma and lymphoma, should be considered in people with advanced HIV who present with diarrhea. And then finally, don't forget medications. A number of the antiretroviral medications, particularly HIV protease inhibitors, can cause diarrhea. And then, of course, antibiotics can cause diarrhea in people with HIV as well as people without HIV. When you think about someone with HIV and you're evaluating diarrhea, if they have acute diarrhea, I would send a stool, a culture, and sensitivity, as well as do C. difficile testing. If they have chronic diarrhea, again, do the same testing above, but also do a stool, ova, and parasite. Ask your lab to look specifically for Cryptosporidia, Microsporidia, Isospora, and Cyclospora. These are specific stains. Do a Giardia antigen. And if there's proctitis, painful defecation, do sexually transmitted infection testing. If a person presents with diarrhea, fever, systemic symptoms, and they have a low CD4 count, particularly if it's less than 50, do AFB blood cultures and also to look for Mycobacterium avium complex, and also do a CMV DNA. And then if the evaluation above is unrevealing, have a low threshold to go on to endoscopy to try to make a microbiologic diagnosis. A word about Salmonella in people with HIV. Salmonella bacteremia is more common in people with HIV, especially if they have low CD4 cell counts, than in people without HIV. So if you see someone with Salmonella bacteremia, make sure that they've had a recent HIV test. Recurrence can be quite common. Back before we had effective antiretroviral therapy, recurrent Salmonella bacteremia was really quite common. When I was a medical student, I saw patients who had multiple episodes of Salmonella bacteremia, and it was really only when we got effective ART, and then those were avoided. Shigella is an important consideration when you see someone with diarrhea. I want to just draw your attention to a CDC alert from 2018 that commented on the increasing number of Shigella isolates that test susceptible to ciprofloxacin with an MIC of between 0.12 and 1 microgram per mil, but which higher resistance genes. In fact, the Department of Health and Human Services said consider treatment, but also commented that treatment may be withheld in people with HIV with a high CD4 count of greater than 500 if they have mild symptoms or whose diarrhea is resolving before cultures return. And then also a reminder to counsel patients to wait to have sex for 1 to 2 weeks after the diarrhea resolves. Another even more recent alert came from the CDC in 2023, really commenting that about 5% of Shigella now in the U.S. is XDR. These are extensively drug-resistant shigellosis. The isolates are resistant to azithromycin, ampicillin, ciprofloxacin, ceftriaxone, and trimethoprim sulfa. These have been occurring mostly in men who have sex with men, people experiencing homelessness, people who've had international travel, as well as people with HIV. And you can see really an uptick over the course of the last 10 years with this curve really rising to that 5% percentage of total Shigella isolates now being XDR. At the time of this alert, there were no treatment recommendations in the UK. Some oral drugs have been used, and also in the UK, a approach of using an IV carbapenem, colistin, was used in hospitalized individuals. Okay, and in the last part of this lecture, we're going to talk about cytomegalovirus, or CMV. So a couple of the highlights about CMV and people with HIV. It's a cause of end-organ disease in people with HIV who have a CD4 cell count of less than 50 and who are not receiving antiretroviral therapy. What do I mean by end-organ disease? Well, CMV can cause retinitis. We already mentioned that CMV can cause colitis. At the outset, we also talked about CMV esophagitis, which presents with odynephagia, which can sometimes be characterized by retrosternal or mid-epigastric pain. CMV can cause neurologic disease. And then CMV pneumonitis is really quite rare in people with HIV. In fact, when CMV is found in a bronchoalveolar lavage, it's frequently a bystander or a commensal and not reflective of invasive disease. How do we prevent CMV disease in people with HIV? Well, first and foremost, antiretroviral therapy to maintain CD4 cell counts of over 100. That's really the mainstay of prevention. Valganciclovir prophylaxis is not recommended for prevention of CMV disease in people with HIV. How do we diagnose HIV-related CMV disease? Well, serology, disease is really quite unlikely if someone is CMV IgG seronegative, so that can be circumstantial evidence. Cytology is rarely useful. Biopsy is really the most important way to diagnose CMV, and it's helpful if there's many inclusions and evidence of substantial inflammation. PCR for CMV correlates with low CD4 cell count, and it's commented that it has less than ideal sensitivity and specificity for clinical disease by the DHHS guidelines. Some of the end organs that I really want to drill in on now are CMV retinitis. This presents with visual changes, decreased visual acuity. This used to be a very feared complication, still is, but used to be a very common manifestation of advanced HIV. The fundoscopic exam in a person with CMV retinitis will show you a bilateral disease in a third of individuals. You can see this mustard and ketchup finding on the retinal exam shown on the right. What this reflects is necrosis of the retina. There's quite little vitreal inflammation, so usually the vitreous is not inflamed. PCR of the blood is not typically that useful. It's 70% sensitive, but can be nonspecific. And then vitreal taps for diagnosis with then sending the vitreal tap for PCR is rarely necessary. If you do a tap, it's positive in about 80%, but really the right clinical setting and this characteristic retinal finding is often how the diagnosis is made. In terms of CMV retinitis treatment, for immediate sight-threatening lesions, start antiretroviral therapy. In conjunction, start intravenous ganciclovir or valganciclovir. Starting off, if you're using these therapies twice a day for 14 to 21 days, and then step down with oral valganciclovir daily for at least 3 to 6 months. In addition, intravitreal ganciclovir weekly over several weeks until the retinal lesions become inactive. And the ganciclovir implant that we used to use in the past is no longer manufactured. So that's for immediate sight-threatening lesions. For small peripheral retinal lesions, antiretroviral therapy again, oral valganciclovir for at least 3 to 6 months and until there's immune reconstitution, and then plus minus intravitreal ganciclovir. For CMV colitis, again, the manifestations, clinical presentation is usually fever, anorexia, abdominal pain, and diarrhea. CMV colitis can cause perforation. So if on the boards there's a person with advanced HIV who has intestinal perforation or intestinal hemorrhage, think about CMV colitis. CT may show colonic thickening or a mass. Diagnosis of CMV colitis is usually with colonoscopy, with cytology or biopsy. The colonoscopy will show mucosal ulcerations. And on biopsy, intranuclear or intracytoplasmic inclusions are typical for CMV. Immunohistochemistry for CMV is also helpful. PCR is typically nonspecific. Therapy for CMV colitis starts with ganciclovir and then over to valganciclovir, and alternative, because it has more toxicity, is fuscarinet. Here are some typical pictures of CMV colitis. You can see the mucosal ulcerations on your left. Here are those inclusions that I mentioned before in the middle. And then finally, in someone with intestinal perforation, you can see mucosal lesions as well as hemorrhage. And then CMV neurologic disease can be manifested as encephalitis. You can also get ventriculoencephalitis, which presents with focal neurologic signs in rapid progression. If imaging is done, there can be periventricular enhancement on MRI or CT. There's also CMV polyradiculopathy or polyradiculomyelopathy, and there's also CMV transverse myelitis. This presents with radicular back pain in a radicular pattern, urinary retention, and bilateral leg weakness. On examination, there can be a spastic myelopathy or sacral paresthesia or kind of a numbness. CSF examination will show neutrophilic pleocytosis anywhere from 100 to 200 cells. So unlike other viruses, which typically give you lymphocytic pleocytosis, CMV gives you a neutrophilic pleocytosis as a manifestation of its necrotic nature. There can also be a low glucose and elevated protein. So with that, I will thank you for your attention and look forward to interacting with you during the course. I appreciate your attendance and all the best to all of you.